Hello, this is Tom Campbell, host of a series of interviews with local musicians and music industry professionals from the 1950s, 60s, and 70s. Today's interview is with Tom Baer from the band Free and Easy. Today is May 26, 2012, and I'm talking with Tom Baer from Free and Easy. Tom, if you don't mind, could you tell us your full name, date of birth, and hometown, please?
Thomas Eugene Baer, 12849 St. Paul, Minnesota.
Okay, and tell us the origins of Free and Easy. How did the band come about, and in what time period?
Well, we were playing with, we had a group been playing for years around the five-state area for Dave and Anthony Productions, and we got to the summer of 1968, and had felt that we wanted to go a different direction. And there was starting to be this transition to jazz rock, and the horns are starting to come in like you would hear Chicago, Blood, Sweat, and Tears, where there was kind of this jazz influence that was morphing with rock, and we thought that would really be interesting, and that would be something we'd want to attack. And also, I had seen years earlier the Fabulous Flippers, who had had a way of taking vocals and great arrangements and great tunes and throwing horns on top that created just a new dimension. And that had always been in the back of my mind, a very dynamic. So I really felt there was a dynamic place you could get to by adding horns to a band that we had to try. Talk to the guys, and they said, let's go for it. So we made a decision. We're going to bring in a couple of trumpet players. And one was Dave Vigran, who played trumpet, trombone, and mellophonium. And the other was Rich Mueller, I should say, who was a trumpet player. And we asked them if they wanted to join our band. We're going to learn some very cool, hip things like Chicago and Earth, Wind, and Fire, and Buddy Miles Express had some stuff out there, and just a whole new area of music we're going to move to. And so we went into rehearsals and started to get a big fat book of music together. And David Anthony was booking us at the time, and he said, I think I got the perfect place I want you guys to audition your new sound for. And it was a club in Chicago called The Garage, and it was on 25 East Chestnut, right off of in the Gold Coast area, right off of Rush Street. And in fact, when we got down to Chicago, they on that weekend, they had something like 15 or 20 acts that started at 10 o'clock in the morning and went till 4 o'clock in the morning, Friday, Saturday, and Sunday. Everything from violin concertos to Tony Bennett-type singers to country bands to you name it. And there Free and Easy was doing its Blood, Sweat, and Tears and Grazing in the Grass and wearing our Edwardian suits and doing our sophisticated music. And we got to Sunday night, and the club owner came up to us and said, we're going to keep two acts here for the next 2 weeks, and you're one of them. So apparently it worked, and we now found ourselves playing in Chicago and with this terrific band, and Chicago loved our sound. And we looked around to see how far we had come. It was amazing. We looked right down the block. Pacific Gas and Electric was playing in one club, and Spiral Staircase was down the street playing in another club. And Don Rickles was at Mr. Kelly's doing his comedic act. And we felt, well, this is sure a good idea. This was a good idea to do all of this. So we're off and running with a new sound and a new excitement.
Okay, so that starts in Chicago. What happens when you return to Minneapolis?
Well, of course, all of our fans from the early days of the He2s, which was our original band, came out and they loved the sound. They loved what we were doing, and they had heard, hey, they went to Chicago, they made it big. So we began to get just a big on a bigger stage, and we were making more of a noise, and it began to play some of the rooms around town, like Mr. Lucky's and Mr. Nibs, and some of the more popular rooms, and we were beginning to make a splash, and it was enjoyable. And we started to actually move into some bars. Where before it was all ballrooms, so we're now starting to see ourselves poking our nose in and playing the CC Tap and playing the Home Bar and some of these bars around town, and we were beginning to really have a lot of fun with it.
And what happens next?
Well, Ralph Ortiz over at Alpha Productions is starting to really make a noise. David Anthony, to this point, was probably considered one of the best agencies in the Twin Cities. And I think everybody loved working for him because he was not a con artist. He was a really, really a people person, loved the music, and bands were loyal to him. He was loyal to them. But there were other people making bigger dents in the Twin City area that making more noise and were beginning to be competition for him. And Ralph Ortiz was one of them. So Ralph had this idea of recording an album with bands that would be playing the five-state area for all the ballrooms and all the high schools and some of these, and we'd get this on the air. And this album would be a promotional tool for his top groups, and he wanted us to be one of those top groups. And so it was going to be recording live at the Depot. And it was a very novel idea. We thought, let's try it. And we went in and recorded a couple of songs. We put together a big vocal arrangement we did on a Three Dog Night song that was called It's For You. And then we tied it in with a Chicago tune, Wake Up Sunshine. And it sort of separated itself on the record as a thing in and of itself that was different. And we thought that would work. And everybody else is pretty much all original and very hip, very cool. Stuff and very good bands, and then we would send them off and we would now start playing a very lucrative college market with this album. And we're probably 2-3 months into this, Ralph came to me and said, you know, I think I have an opening in the agency, and I think you have the kind of mind that would do well at this, and I could train you, but I would like you to open up a branch to move these bands into nightclubs in the Twin Cities area. We use the same concept that we're using for the colleges. You send the club owners the album, let them pick out a band. And I said, sure, I'll try it. And first thing that happened is I send the album out to all the club owners in town, and I begin to follow up with my calls. Have you decided who you'd like to use for your nightclub? And they said, sure, nobody. I said, really? They go, you got to be kidding me.
Nobody
on the album. Everybody, we're talking long hair, original music, loud music. We're a nightclub. We want commercial bands. We want them dressed well. We want them doing music everybody likes. And it's, you don't have anything that we want. And so I looked at Ralph and I said, Ralph, I said, I know what they want. They want, and I can build that. I can design Free and Easy to be that. And what it really is, I said, it can be musical and can be good, but it's got to be commercial. And we aren't. We're way too out there. And so I had recommended that I could let me revamp Free and Easy to fit that formula so we could open up the doors for nightclubs for other bands. And that became the goal. So I met with the guys to discuss that. And of course, Tom and Tony, the two of the original members, said, no, we want to move towards original music. So they decided to go that direction. And I took Free and Easy more into a commercial vein. And of course, I wanted to move into, I was starting to hear R&B more so on albums through friends, not so much on the air, because this is a pretty bigoted market, but I was beginning to hear the new Earth, Wind, and Fire stuff, the new Tower of Power stuff. There was nice stuff that was starting to come in that was R&B, and club owners were scared to death of it. And so, but I wanted to do it, and I was willing to risk that. I thought there was enough there where I could bring that music in and it would appeal to every market. It wouldn't turn this thing into a market where you got to be worried about you segregating your crowds or unsegregating your crowds or what have you. And so the first challenge was to find a soulful singer that could do this music. And of course, I was not allowed to put a black man or woman in the band. That wasn't allowed in clubs. And I thought, this is ridiculous. So one night I'm watching This Must Be the Place, and Dave Moore's show, and I see a familiar face, Dave Rodriguez, who was with Davey and the Deltones when I was 13, 14 years old, watching him as a kid, and I'm going, I love the way this guy sings. Well, he's back at it, and he's singing this great R&B stuff. He's got a fabulous voice, and he's in some band playing in the Burnsville Bowl. So I called the Burnsville Bowl, and I found out how to get a hold of Dave. And I called him. I said, Dave, I've got a band that I'm putting together. I think you'd be perfect for it. I'd like to talk to you about it. So I went and talked to him about being the lead singer of Free and Easy. And he said he'd love to do it. So we get ready. We are set up for rehearsals at the Alpha Productions in the back room. My drummer's there, keyboard player. Everybody's there ready to go, and there's no Dave. So I get on the phone, I'm calling, where's Dave, where's Dave? Well, he met somebody in a bar and never showed up for rehearsal. So the next day I call him, he goes, what's up? I go, what's up? Where were you? He goes, oh, I was out. I go, Dave, if we're going to have a band and we're going to have a business and you want guys to respect this gig, you got to be there. That was getting to know Dave and training Dave how to play by the rules. But what a talent, and what the most talented singer I've ever met in my life, complete natural. And so brought Dave on board, and we put this band together, and it was so talented. And we were doing these fabulous arrangements.
So Tom, who's in the new version of Free and Easy?
It would be Dave Rodriguez on lead vocals and guitar, Dave Peterson on bass and lead vocals, and the third Dave is Dave Vigorin on trumpet and trombone and flugelhorn. And on drums, Ron Lundquist, trumpet, Terry Stadansky, and then I played guitar, keys, and sax and sang. And we went into heavy rehearsals, and we're doing a lot of just great arrangements on Chicago, Blood, Sweat, and Tears, commercial top 40 tunes, heavily moving towards the R&B thing. Earth, Wind was beginning to come in. Tower was beginning to come in and be a factor. And we're going to introduce this music into nightclubs that were used to Proud Mary and quartets with the girl singers with ratted hair. That was the climate of nightclubs back in the early 70s.
So Tom, you had been out to sort of scout out the competition?
Yes, I was. And it was interesting when the club owners told me what they wanted, they told me who to go see. And I won't name names, but I went out there and I saw why. I saw where the success was and why the success was. And there wasn't much competition out there, but where there was a semblance of a professional act that was doing commercial danceable music, there was tremendous success. But I looked at it and said, it could be so much better. It could really be as musical. My thought was, let's put a band on a stage that you could be paying money to see play at the St. Paul Auditorium, or you could be paying to see them at the State Fair Grandstand Show, or you're walking into a nightclub to see them. It's the same level, the same musicianship, the same quality of show. And I said, that's what we need. But the only thing that's required is that it's commercial and danceable. And I thought, that's a simple solution. And when we attacked it that way, and started to put this together, I said, we're going to change the face of the Twin Cities music scene. We really are. And I was excited about it. So we put the band together, went to the CC Tap on a Sunday, and Ralph had brought in all these club owners that were going to watch us. And we would play a set, and then the club owner walk out, and in walk another club owner, and we play a set. And this would have been right around January of 72. And what happened was the owner of the CC Tap said to Ralph, why are you waltzing people in here to see this band? I want this band. He says, well, you don't have house bands. He goes, I want them as our house band. So we kind of became the house band of the CC Tap, and we said, well, it's a 3-2 joint. We'd be happy to be here. We appreciate the work, but we would be moving on. But we began as the house band there. And one Tuesday night, on ladies' night, Ralph brings Joe Aragone in, who had the club that everybody in town wanted to play, in Sibley Plaza in West St. Paul. And the reason everybody in town wanted to be there was he only used road acts, and he would get most of them out of Chicago. They were Holiday Inn lounge bands, except once in a while he'd bring in Wayne Cochran and the CC Riders and bring in something truly spectacular. So he was an Italian club owner that really had a flair for live music. It would be the perfect venue for us, because it could be highly professional. It's St. Paul. I know St. Paul like the back of my hand. I figured that would be great. So Joe came in. He says, I'll try him for 2 weeks, a two-week schedule. So we went in there. And what's funny is Ralph said, we have to have a show. They're all show bands. And I said, we're not a show band, Ralph. He says, you got to be for this. So we worked up a few bits. One of them was where we worked up The Age of Aquarius by The Fifth Dimension, whereas when we get to the Let the Sun Shine, the horn players run out of the audience. They're standing on two tables across the room from each other, blowing horns at each other. Dave's got a 50-foot cord, and he's walking around the club getting people to sing, and we had people standing on the tables and chairs. The place went crazy. And we opened up on a ladies' night, on a Tuesday night. It was so crazy that Ralph told me Joe Aragone had called and said, I canceled all my other bands. They're now my new house band. And literally, that's when the whole game changed. And the Jockey Lounge now became central theme for where the music was going to be headed in the 1970s. And it changed everything. And this band changed everything. And this band was so influential that every musician in town would come out to watch this band. Not only that, every woman in town that wanted to dance, that loved sexy, dancing, danceable, great music. And then, of course, that pulled all the guys in. So they had it all. This group appealed to everybody. And very interesting enough was that one day in the late 1980s, I get a... I'm leaving the restroom of a... And I run into Jelly Bean from The Time. And Jelly Bean says, Free and Easy Jockey Lounge, 72. I go, wow, good memory. I go, you were there? He goes, I was there. He says, I was there. Prince was there. We were all there with our notebooks, man. You guys, he said, you guys hadn't been around the block. You built the block. You were doing all this funky, cool stuff, man. And you were white guys doing this funky, funky, cool stuff. And Funky Town was born, in a sense. And we were. And what's so funny, here was the trade-off. Because they were so afraid that somehow we would change the culture of the Twin Cities and the ghetto make them into nightclubs, that for every R&B tune that Free and Easy learned, we had to balance it with a Young Rascals tune or a Beach Boys tune, so that we are a variety. And honest to God, that was the culture. And what ended up happening was that people were so starved for the music that we were bringing in that pretty soon other bands would come in to watch what we're doing, and they're playing it everywhere, and you couldn't stop this funk R&B thing from happening. It was happening, and it was undeniable, and it was amazing. And we then were getting requests to play everywhere in town. Now, we had been played in over a year at the Jockey, maybe into our second year. And finally, I said to Ralph, I said, I got to let this band play other rooms. I got to get them out of here. Well, how are we going to replace them? And I said, well, I think the Mystics would be a good replacement, but they're a black band. I go, perfect. That's the point. And you know what? I said, just have them wear suits. They'll be fine. They came in. Now, all of a sudden, the Mystics could play nightclubs because the music was accepted. Well, then if the Mystics could, well, then so could Hayes. And Hayes was a fabulous band. And ran into Solly and a couple of those guys and ran into them recently. And they said, you know what, man? You guys opened the door for us to come in and play. And it opened the door for a lot of that. And remember, there was Josh Weaver and Candy Anderson with Good Vibrations. And Candy Anderson was one of the Iquettes. And you talk about a band that was funky. And it was just all these funky bands came in, and the scene got very, very healthy. It was very good for everybody. And it was kind of fun, as we were sort of had a lot to do with saying, this is what people want. You know, there's nothing, it's good. It's a good thing. So that's kind of that's the long and short of it.
Why don't you give us a couple songs that the band covered at this time period?
Well, of course, when we first started playing, we would be doing a lot of the early Earth, Wind, Keep Your Head to the Sky. Yet you had Cold Blood, Down to the Bone. You had some Edgar Winter's White Trash, very nice stuff. So it was pretty funky and pretty edgy. It was a great renaissance time for music. And I mean, jazz was starting to meet funk, was starting to meet commercial, and it was all being accepted. And the only key we had to make sure was that it was danceable. We couldn't turn this into a concert and make people sit down and watch us. We had to break the ice. The whole idea was people would tend to, if they watch you, they're going to watch you all night. You got to break that glass bubble and get them on the dance floor, turn it into a room where everybody's expressing, where the dancers are expressing like the musicians are playing, and you create this creative place. And in fact, what was so interesting about those days was we would be done playing on a Friday night. Well, then it's like, where's the party? And then oftentimes it wasn't at our place, but then we'd be there. These people would bring their albums and say, check this out. And everybody was bringing albums, and we'd be hearing new music from groups we've never heard about because it wasn't being played on the radio. In fact, that's how we first heard about early Earth, Wind, and Fire. It wasn't on the radio. Somebody was playing it. I said, what is that? And then we started playing it in the club, war stuff, the war music. And it was Buddy Miles Express. So there was so much music going on. People really were in love with discovering music. And the Twin Cities was, you know, it took a noticeable switch. And it's so interesting now when you really think about who's made it out of this town. You look at Prince, it's kind of a funky hip thing he's doing. You look at Jimmy Jam and Terry Lewis, it's all funky, funky stuff. And of course, we are known as Funky Town. So it ended up being something that we're known for now, and we're more so than R&B, we're kind of a funk town, in my opinion.
So you had interest from other club owners mm-hmm. at that time. How did you deal with that situation?
Well, it was interesting, is what we had to do was, for us to be free to go out and play more clubs, more bands had to come in and be successful at what we began to do, what we started. So that pretty soon, the formula was set. You could be musical, you could be commercial. Kind of the rules were set, and here's how it went. So we had a very thriving area. And as we began to grow, the word spread around town. Other club owners started to check out what we're doing, and one was the Crystal Mist. The Crystal Mist got together at the Jockey Lounge and said, somebody could build another band like Free and Easy, and we could alternate. That was the first step. We actually did was I built a group called Gangbusters, produced a band for Ralph Ortez, and it was a five-piece band that had a couple of horns in it, very, very commercial, very, very successful. They would begin to alternate. We would go and play a month at the Crystal Mist in Maplewood, and Gangbusters would replace us at the Jockey Lounge, and then vice versa. So we started to get the circulation going. Then all of a sudden, there were more clubs that wanted us. So that's when we began to bring other bands with other formulas into the mix, like the Mystics, like Good Vibrations, like the Hayes band that we had discussed earlier. Then all of a sudden, the table was set, and bands were now, the formula was established, and bands were now out there, kind of everybody sort of saying, trying to stretch the rule, here's the rules, but then trying to stretch the rule book so that they had their own unique problem. And I would say it was the heyday for music in this town. We had, in fact, I would have people come up from Chicago and say the music in Minneapolis was far superior than the music in Chicago. And I had agencies in Chicago calling us, and they couldn't afford to pay us what we were making here in town. They said, you guys got a better pay scale and better music scene going on in Minneapolis than we do in Chicago. So we did something right. Something was beginning to really work.
You took a risk.
Yes. But you know what's so interesting, and it's so funny you should use that word. It never seems like you've taken a risk if you followed your heart. And you know, it's so funny for all of us. If we follow our hearts, we have such enthusiasm because we know what the outcome will be, because we're doing inspired, motivated work. And when you do inspired, motivated work, it has to succeed because you see it in your head, and you just and you're being directed and guided. When we play it safe, we're playing not to lose. And when you play not to lose, all you're doing is covering your bases. You end up with a mediocre product. So yes, I've been a risk taker. Never felt that I was taking a risk because I had conviction that there's a right way to do things. And if I could find that right way to do things, it will succeed.
So it never really occurred to you that your plan may not work?
Not at all. Not at all. To me, it was obvious why things weren't working until I came up with a plan. Nobody had thought deep enough. See, people never give the public the credit. I've always looked at it this way. Half the people out there know what music is. They really have a musical sense. And those people will only listen to music that's musical, that's being played the right way. I don't care what it is. If it's Lawrence Welk's band, I don't care if it's hard rock, country, if it's played right, they're going to respect it. Then you got the other half, and those are the ones that are out there clapping on 1 and 3. Those are the ones that are out there that don't know the difference. They're having a ball. They think it's all great. And they're valid, too. They've got to be catered to, so you can't play over their heads or treat them like they're insignificant. So when you once make a decision that every piece of music you're going to play is going to relate to every type of person that's out there, you're not going to play over their heads. You're not going to insult their intelligence. And you're going to deliver music professionally. You haven't segregated the market. You've included the market. And you've got a bigger market to draw from. And so that's why I always insisted I couldn't play with musicians that weren't musical. I didn't care how fat they were. I didn't care how skinny they were. I didn't care what nationality they were. All I wanted to know was, could they play? Because in my opinion, I couldn't play with somebody that couldn't play. I couldn't do that to an audience, is have a band up there pretending to play. There are a lot of bands up there that are pretending to play because they're up there for other reasons. But we're fortunate. In fairness, we came through the greatest era, being a boomer, of discovering music in the 50s, 60s, and actuating in the 70s and the 80s. And seeing this great opportunity in front of us. And most of us lived a life of being a full-time professional musician, could raise a family, buy a home, buy a car, live a decent life, and really pursue the art of music and entertainment. With the advent of corporate America, and with the advent of corporate bars, I'll never forget a good friend of mine, Mark Rowe, who used to work for Good Music Agency, and he and I worked in our own agency together. Back in the early 1980s, had said to me when we were sitting up at Niccolo's watching Free and Easy play, he says, enjoy this, it ain't going to last. I said, what are you talking about, enjoy this, it isn't going to last? He said, TGIFs just came into Edina. I said, so? He said, they're going to Burnsville. They're going everywhere. And there's a whole bunch of them, Bennigan's. So there's a whole bunch of them coming in after. I said, what difference does that make? He said, here's the difference. They're franchise corporate restaurant bars whose goal is to eliminate talent. They do not want live music. They don't want to pay. They want to control everything. They're going to control the menus. They're going to control the pricing. They're going to control what they look like, these places look like. So people are, they're going to be formulaic. and the, with the whole idea of getting rid of live music because it's an expense they don't need. He said the only place you're ever going to see live music is going to be if it's an Italian club or a Greek club. I said, what? He goes, think about it. When the mob ran Las Vegas, it was Sinatra. It was the Rat Pack. It was music. What happened? When the mob stopped running Las Vegas, it became Holiday on Ice. It became the production shows. They lost it was just the no-name dancers, the no-name singers, the no-name trapeze artists. It was like, just get in line. You're an employee of ours. And that, with that culture, we stopped getting professional musicians playing in nightclubs. And so consequently, today's musician plays in four bands. He works a full-time gig to pay the bills. They never rehearse. They email their song list to each other. Okay, you're going to sing this, you're going to sing that. What tunes do you sing lead on? What tunes do you sing lead on? They show up for some of these gigs and they meet each other for the first time. That's the climate. And then you've got a lot of them don't have time to practice. They don't have, not only in their own craft, but with each other. So there's nothing really being developed. So I look at that and I said, where's the culture for these kids? I mean, when we were 17, 18 years old, we were putting in 5-6 hours a day in the summer, rehearsing 7 days a week. And then we had an opportunity to go out and play 2-3 nights a week. I mean, it was there to develop your skill. There's not that environment now. So we're in a point in time where it's a sad time for the music business.